Good morning, and welcome to the Silvercrest Asset Management Group's second quarter investor call. Mr. Moffett Cochrane will now begin.
Good morning. I'm CEO of Silvercrest. Joining me today is Scott Gerard, our CFO, and Rick Hough, our president. We are very pleased to be reporting our first quarterly earnings as a public company. As Scott and Rick will report in greater detail, it was a good quarter for Silvercrest. Substantial year-over-year increases were recorded in AUM, revenue, EBITDA, and net income for the same periods in 2012. In particular, we are pleased to see our EBITDA margin above 30% for the quarter and for the 6 months ending June 30. Before turning it over to Rick and Scott, I would like to make a few general comments. 2 months ago, we were on the verge of kicking off the roadshow, which culminated in our initial public offering on June 27th of this year. As we traveled the country telling our story, we made the following points at every stop. One, in the ultra-high net worth space, we saw almost unlimited growth potential if we were able to continue to deliver excellent service and performance to these clients. Two, in the institutional space, we felt we were at an inflection point with institutional consultants with whom we were just beginning to get traction. And three, in the M&A space, we felt that our ability to do additional deals would be greatly enhanced by the cash and public stock that would come from the IPO. We also emphasized that the growth we felt confident we would achieve would be uneven, unpredictable, and would require patience. Based on our record of success in each of these areas, however, we were confident the patient investor would be well rewarded. Now that we are 48 days into the life of a public company, none of our views on these topics has changed. In the ultra-high net worth space, Silvercrest continues to have meetings and conversations with individuals of extraordinary wealth. Because there is no deadline for action, however, these conversations are not brought to closure until the client decides he or she is completely comfortable with the outcome. Sometimes this takes weeks, sometimes it takes years. In any event, it is unpredictable, and we will not attempt to make predictions of this sort. In the quarter ended June 30th, our new business success was somewhat muted, although the second quarter of each year is characterized by substantial outflows to the taxing authorities. During the quarter, we gained three new relationships. In the institutional space, we continue to be invited into finals presentations for institutional managers seeking new management, and we continue to win a good number of mandates from this effort. In the quarter ended June 30th, we were awarded institutional mandates totaling $62 million, and in the current quarter to date, we await decision on a number of mandates. Our institutional pipeline is large and growing and looks encouraging. M&A. During the IPO process, we largely suspended our efforts to identify merger or acquisition candidates. Now that the IPO is behind us, we are reactivating that effort, which is a priority for us. And moving forward on this front, we intend to follow the same formula we have used to date. Target small firms whose clients and principals are culturally compatible with our own, integrate them fully with Silvercrest, and build out the acquired business on the new Silvercrest platform. We intend to focus only on firms located in major money centers in the U.S. In addition to gaining clients and relationship managers, we will be alert to opportunities to do acquisitions, which would expand our suite of core investment capabilities as well. Scott Gerard and Rick Hough will now provide a more detailed analysis of our operations for the second quarter and year-to-date 2013, following which we will open it up for a few questions. Scott, Rick.
Thank you, Moffitt. As everyone read in our earnings release for the second quarter, AUM as of June 30th was $13.9 billion. Revenue for the quarter was $14.5 million, and reported net income for the quarter was $5.5 million. Please keep in mind that the results for the 3 and 6 months ended June 30th, 2013, are those of our accounting predecessor, Silvercrest LP, and as a result, our statement of operations and cash flows do not take into consideration changes related to our IPO, given that our shares only commenced trading on June 27th. Revenue for the second quarter was $14.5 million, representing approximately a 12% increase over revenue of $12.9 million for the same period last year. This increase was driven primarily by growth in our management and advisory fees as a result of increased AUM. Expenses for the second quarter were $8.7 million, representing approximately a 16% increase over expenses of $7.5 million for the same period last year. This increase was primarily attributable to increases in compensation and benefits expense of $1.1 million and to a much lesser extent, general and administrative expenses. Increase in compensation and benefits expense was primarily attributable to a special one-time non-principal bonus expense of approximately $750,000 directly related to the IPO, which was paid in July of 2013 upon the consummation of the offering. The balance of the increase in compensation and benefits expenses due to both merit increases and increased headcount. The increase in general administrative expenses was primarily due to an increase in occupancy expense, and this is because in 2012 we had a reversal of a lease abandonment liability for space that we reoccupied, so therefore this had the effect of reducing occupancy expense last year. Furthermore, this increase was primarily offset by a reduction in professional fees, as in the beginning of 2012, we had to expend some residual IPO-related fees related to the planned IPO that ultimately was withdrawn in November of last year. Reported net income was $5.5 million for the quarter as compared to $5.1 million in the same period last year. Keep in mind, reported net income does not include the effect of partner incentive payments, as these will begin to be expensed in the third quarter when changes related to the IPO will begin to be reflected in our statement of operations and cash flow. Adjusted EBITDA, which we define as EBITDA without giving effect to equity-based compensation expense and non-recurring items, but does include the effect of partner incentive payments, was $4.4 million or 30.4% of revenue for the quarter, compared to $3.3 million or 25.8% of revenue for the same period last year. Adjusted net income, which we define as net income without giving effect to non-recurring items, but inclusive of both the effect of partner incentive payments and income tax expense, assuming a standard corporate rate of 40%, was $2.1 million for the quarter or 18 cents per adjusted basic and diluted share. Adjusted earnings per share is basically equal to adjusted net income divided by the actual Class A and Class B shares outstanding as of the end of the reporting period for basic adjusted EPS. And to the extent dilutive, we add unvested deferred equity units and performance units to total basic shares outstanding to compute diluted adjusted EPS. With respect to the first half of the year, revenue for the first half was $28.2 million, representing approximately a 14% increase over revenue of $24.8 million for the same period last year. Again, this was primarily driven by growth in management and advisory fees as a result of increased AUM. Expenses for the first half were $16.6 million, representing approximately a 12% increase over expenses of $14.8 million for the same period last year. This increase, again, was primarily attributable to compensation and benefits expense increases and, to a lesser extent, G&A expense increases. For the same reasons we're driving the variances for the quarter applied to the first half of the year with respect to, comp and G&A. Reported net income was does not include partner incentive payments and will begin to reflect the expensing of the partner incentive payments in the third quarter when the IPO, again, is reflected in our statement of operations. Adjusted EBITDA, was $8.5 million or 30.3% of revenue for the first half, compared to $6.8 million or 27.3% of revenue for the same period last year. Adjusted net income was $3.9 million for the first half, or 35 cents per basic adjusted EPS and 33 cents per basic and diluted shares, respectively. With respect to our statement of financial condition, our balance sheet does reflect the various IPO transactions because it's at a point in time and because our shares did commence trading on June 27th. Total assets were $114.3 million as of June 30th, compared to $52.5 million as of December 31st last year. Cash and cash equivalents were $12.7 million at the end of June, compared to $13.4 million as of December 31st last year. We had notes payable of approximately $9.6 million at June 30th and $3.3 million at December 31st of last year. In June of this year, we entered into a $15 million credit facility with City National Bank, which is comprised of a revolving credit facility and a delayed draw term loan. Prior to the consummation of the IPO, we drew down $7 million on a revolving credit facility in anticipation of using it to partially fund the $10 million pre-IPO distribution that was paid to existing limited partners of Silvercrest Limited Partnership. Again, that was prior to the closing of the IPO. And as everyone knows, on July 2nd, we did officially complete our IPO by issuing approximately 4.8 million Class A common shares, which began trading on June 27th on NASDAQ. Our ticker is SAMG. The net proceeds from the IPO, which were received on July 2nd of this year, was approximately $48.2 million. In connection with the IPO, we used a portion of the net proceeds to purchase approximately 3.4 million Class B units from partners of Silvercrest LP. The cost of those units on a net basis was approximately $35.4 million. The amounts that were due to the Silvercrest partners that sold on the offering were paid out as well on July 2nd. As a result of our IPO-related reorganization, total stockholders' equity as of June 30th was $26.1 million. And that concludes my remarks, for the quarter, and, we'll open it up to questions, as Moffitt had stated. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone now. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone at this time. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if there are any questions or comments at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. There are no questions in queue. So we do have a question from Steven with Raymond James Associates. Please go ahead, sir.
Hey, guys. And by the way, I hit star 1 a number of times, and it just registered, so there might be some more people
Thanks, Steve.
Out there.
How you doing?
Good. How y'all doing?
Well, thanks.
A couple of questions for Scott. Scott, the I think the AUM presentation, the role, is that done in the same manner as the S-1?
Correct.
Okay. Can we look at this in a different way if you have those numbers? I think Moffitt said you had three families that came in the quarter. How much did they account for?
This is Rick. Steve, those three families, which rise to the level of our accounting of relationship, accounted only for about $20 million in the quarter. When we look at a new relationship, we measure it when it's opened, in the month it's opened. Additional flows for relationships count as existing flows in or out, and they could have been substantial above that.
Okay, let me ask it a different way then. If we were to look at this as gross flows from new relationships, that would be the $20 million that you just cited.
Plus at least $62 million in new institutional accounts.
Okay, those were funded?
Yes.
Okay, and then what would be closed accounts, if any?
There were no lost relationships, which is very important for our business. I think we talked about this quite a bit on the roadshow. As Moffitt mentioned in his introductory remarks, this is a business where we're going after very high net worth individuals. It can be a very long courtship and quite lumpy in terms of quarter-to-quarter results. The business has grown substantially over time by attracting those assets, but then most importantly, retaining them so it's more of an annuity once we've gained a client relationship. Our emphasis here has to be on superb client service so the business doesn't work and maintaining that client relationship. So the fact we didn't lose any relationships is very important. When you look at closed accounts, for the quarter, there was only $1.4 million, which is hardly even worth mentioning, and accounts that were actually closed out, that was the amount of money that was left. That just means someone may have switched strategies or they harvested money out of an account before actually closing it out. There may have been other net outflows, as obviously you saw in our AUM numbers, for things like taxes or other events. But an actual closeout or closed relationship, there's nothing to speak of.
Okay, so the difference here is simply going to be client withdrawals from their accounts for normal reasons, including tax purposes and the like, right?
Precisely, and as we mentioned in the queue, the first and second quarters of the year, depending when cash is raised, tend to be our heaviest outflows because of the tax.
Okay, and then Richard, if you could remind us, what percentage of, just for modeling purposes, what percentage of assets would be in fixed income?
Approximately 40%. It's actually been decreasing slightly, but that's a good example for modeling purposes. For those who may not be familiar, you may recall that we tend to fee on a relationship across the board, and therefore the marginal change in fee revenue from people switching from fixed income to equity matters, but people tend to have long-term asset allocations. We're focused on the fee basis for a relationship and the quality of the relationship, and you don't find huge differentials there over time.
Okay, and then one more, if I may. You recently hired a gentleman, started up an office in Los Angeles. Anything new out on the West Coast?
I will mention that we are building out that office still. It's very new. I'm just going to anticipate a question, which is about M&A, and mention that the firm is in discussions with various parties all the time and looking to build our various offices around the country, and that remains a potential there as it does elsewhere. We have a good new business pipeline, including in Los Angeles.
Okay. All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
We have another question from Michael with Sandler O'Neill. Please go ahead, sir.
Guys, good morning. So first, if I look at the shorter-term returns across your proprietary equity strategies, there's some underperformance relative to benchmark. So just wondering to what extent, if at all, that's had any impact on your efforts to increasingly penetrate the institutional channel?
I would say that it hasn't affected us at all. If anything, the pipeline for institutional business has picked up. As Moffitt mentioned, it remains robust, and we feel very encouraged about the institutional attention we're getting. I also think there's been a closing of any underperformance over the past several months.
It's also the case, if I may, that the institutions are quite interested in making sure that you adhere to your stated discipline, even if it happens to be slightly out of sync with the market. And we've done that for many years, and they like that.
Got it. That's helpful. Okay. And then just to come back to the M&A discussion, can you talk about what you're seeing in terms of you know, opportunities, competition, and maybe pricing trends out there, and how the market backdrop has maybe impacted potential discussions with firms, if at all.
Sure. Moffitt, do you want me to take that one to start?
Yeah, why don't you do that?
Okay. We're seeing, I think, a little bit more interest in firms that would be willing to sell. The uptick in the market, of course, means that they can potentially get a better price for their business, even if it's not based on an increase in multiples, just due to their own revenue and profitability. With a better market, it looks like a better time for some firms to talk. So I think there's a little bit more action. The second part of your question has to do with competition. At the size firms that we're typically speaking with and that we have started conversations with in a casual manner, I haven't yet seen a lot of buyers at the table. It may be that our particular mix of business either appeals to those businesses in such a way that other institutions aren't as favorable as Silvercrest, or that they're just small enough that our larger aggregators, which we don't consider ourselves, aren't in the marketplace for those businesses. We're really new back into the discussion, so we're just getting into it, so I wouldn't want to comment further beyond that generalization.
Okay, that's helpful. And then just maybe a final one for Scott. How should we be thinking about potential margin expansion over time? Is it mostly a function of continuing to ramp up the institutional business, or are there opportunities to maybe extract some further economies of scale as your legacy high net worth business continues to grow?
Basically, you know, as we spoke about on the roadshow, you know, to the extent that institutional business does, you know, comprise a larger portion of our AUM, I think there will be, you know, an opportunity there to, you know, expand our margins as well. And just, you know, as a discipline overall, the firm is, you know, with 38 partners, you know, we're constantly, you know, cognizant of effective cost management in running the business. You know, we've all got a lot invested in the business. So, but, you know, you are correct. The institutional AUM mix represents an opportunity for margin expansion.
This is Rick. With regards to the second half of your clients, your question with regards to legacy clients, we have contracts with set fees for the relationship. We try to remain as unbiased as possible in dealing with our clients. It's one of our key selling points in terms of the quality of the service and transparency of our business to our clients. And as I've mentioned, the long-term allocations serve our clients best. And so you're likely to see, as Scott said, the margin expansion more from the institutional side.
Okay, got it. Thanks for taking my questions.
Sure, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have another question from Mr. Steven at Raymond James. Please go ahead, sir.
Hey, I like being Mr. Steven. Just a quick one on the institutional front that Richard's question reminded me of, or Mike's question, excuse me. The CalSTRS, I think there was still some of the mandate that had not been funded. Has there been any movement there?
There is not.
There is not. Okay, that's what I have. Thanks.
Thank you.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if there are any more questions or comments, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. There are no more callers in queue.
Okay, well, thank you very much for attending our first investor conference call. Moffitt, do you have any concluding remarks?
No. We look forward to reporting to you each quarter, and thank you very much for your interest today.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude the conference. You may all disconnect.